Good morning. It's 8:30 on Tuesday, April 16th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, attorneys claim a 15-year-old student from Canton was physically assaulted by her school resource officer. Then, healthcare experts say getting pregnancy health screenings can greatly increase the survival rate of premature births. Plus, a new book shares the experience of an NPR journalist who left the white evangelical church. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. The city of Canton and the Canton Public School District could be facing a lawsuit. A middle school student claims she was assaulted by the school resource officer. On April 4th, 15-year-old eighth grader Tatiana Francois of Nichols, middle school, was allegedly attacked on her way to the bathroom. She says Jaya Parker came across and dragged her hair and choked her. Alexis Davis is Tatiana's mother.
She was drugged. Her hair was pulled. Her braid was pulled from the root. And she was choked using a tactic she showed on me, and I hit her back, but it was a tactic used on her neck.
No, we're not going to do all the demonstrations. She still needs some treatment physically and emotionally, and we don't want her to have to relive it too vividly right now.
She was verbally assaulted the assistant principal and resource officer/officer yelled in her face. So she was asked to get down in a push-up position, something I guess you learn in police academy. Words can't explain what I've been grieving. I can't really explain. I'm just walking around every day, but, you know, I just hate it happened to her.
You also just heard comments from attorney Carlos Moore, who is representing Tatiana and her mother. He says Officer Parker has been fired by the Canton School District, but remains employed by the police department.
We are here to call for the immediate termination of that officer. Any trained law enforcement officer knows that you do not assault a 15-year-old, an eighth grader. I understand that this brutal assault was caught on camera. The school system has refused to release the footage to the mother, Alexis Davis. She's asked for it. They have refused to let her see the video footage. We call for an immediate release of the video. We're asking, we are demanding that the video be voluntarily released. If it is not voluntarily released, we will take the appropriate legal actions to get a copy of that video. The public deserves to know what they paid someone to do. To beat this young lady. She was on the public payroll. That's a public video, and the public deserves to see what went on that led to that brutal assault and to that termination by the school district. And we want to make sure the chief of police sees what his officer did. Maybe he has not seen it. Maybe that's why that officer is still employed by the Canton Police Department. Well, everyone needs to be transparent, and everyone needs to be held fully accountable. Not only can the city and the school district expect a civil lawsuit, but Ms. Davis wants Jaya Parker held responsible in the criminal arena. She's already spoken with the law enforcement officers in Canton, but to me, I don't believe that a law enforcement office can really investigate its own officer. I believe an independent agency needs to investigate and prosecute, and so she will be filing a criminal affidavit with the Madison County Justice Court, criminal affidavit for them, someone that's independent, to make sure that justice is served in the criminal arena. I've been hired as a civil lawyer, and we will file a civil lawsuit at the appropriate time against those responsible, the officer and her employers, both the school district and the city of Canton.
Since the alleged attack, Tatiana Francois hasn't returned to school and is seeking counseling for emotional trauma. Davis says the attack began when her daughter asked to get some water from another teacher.
And the resource officer/officer was standing there talking to the teacher that normally gives her water. And from there, she said something about her headphone, which, according to Tatiana, everybody else gets a chance to wear headphones. And not only that, 2 weeks before this, 2 weeks of March, I know, I think the 20th, it was a student that brought in a gun, drugs, intending on shooting up the school, but she got hurt. So it was a target on the back. She couldn't be like everyone else. So it had to be true, because why didn't he get the same treatment? Not saying I want anybody's child hurt, not saying that. But why was she a threat when she wasn't really a threat? And I can say in how I feel, I did not know they hated my child. They hated my child. And I wouldn't have never sent her there. If I knew that, I wouldn't have sent my child there.
Both the Canton School District and Police Department declined to comment for this story. Davis says her daughter wasn't expecting such a violent attack and says several school employees and faculty saw what happened.
It was several teachers. It was the coach. It just wasn't her, but she had the authority to put her hands. Not really authority. She joined in and she had a choice, because if I come up to the school, I could hear them in the corner. I just didn't let them know I could hear them before they got to me. So all of them played a role. It wasn't until that the principal, he saw the video. Now, he was remorseful after he saw the video. I will say that. But it took him to see the video. He didn't stand with a child. He stood with adults. That's the main problem. I got all them went against my child and let her screamed out for help. No help came. Now, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get over that. So I'm assuming before the video, she probably could have got away with it. Everybody stood with each other. All these years, everybody stood with each other. Even some of the other staff, they know, superintendent, he knew. Nobody was remorseful. I'm assuming Mr. Evans, after he saw the video, but I just hate that it took you to see the video to be remorseful.
Coming up, healthcare advocates say getting pregnancy health screenings can greatly increase the survival rate of very premature births. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pohl Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Said. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
An evening of jazz can be just what the doctor ordered. Join me, Meredith Michelle, with WJSU's Evening Jazz, 7 to 10 weeknights on MPB Music Radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Healthcare providers are meeting at St. Dominic Hospital in Jackson this week to determine best practices for treating the state's most vulnerable babies. Around 15% of babies born in Mississippi are premature. Some are called micro preemies. Those are babies that are born before the 26th week of pregnancy or weigh less than 2 pounds. For context, a full-term pregnancy takes around 40 weeks and the baby would weigh about 7 pounds. Neonatal nurse practitioner Katie Fulton is an organizer of the event and says early intervention can give a baby a much better chance at survival when they are very premature.
So we consider babies that are less than 37 weeks is technically premature. We have late preterms, which are kind of in that 35 to 37 week category, and then less than 35 weeks would be considered preterm. They move into that micropreemie category if they're less than 1,000 grams. So 1,000 grams is around 2 pounds, so babies that are 2 pounds or less. And so that's kind of what constitutes them being a micropreemie and technically around 26 to 28 weeks gestation.
What is the survival rate for a baby that's 2 pounds?
So it's based on several different things. We have survival calculators that we use, and we can put in information and see what the likelihood of a positive outcome would be. This has improved greatly over the last 10, 15 years, I would say. And, you know, babies that are 25 weeks and greater have a much greater risk of surviving and doing well, flourishing. So I would say 25 weeks is probably that mark where they have really good outcomes. We do resuscitate babies that are younger than that, but all of that is based on counseling with families and looking at the probability of outcomes with the families and making decisions based on what they would like for us to do.
Mississippi has the highest rate of infant mortality in the country. I was looking at some stats. It's at Mississippi, 14.8%. So when you think about the number of preemies that don't survive, what can you possibly do differently? Is it the lack of technology in Mississippi?
I would say that in a lot of the outcomes are based on the ability to get quality care prenatally. The health of the mothers on the front end definitely has a role to play in the outcomes for the babies. So just improving access to care and improving the quality of care could have an effect on the outcomes of the babies. This is one of the reasons that we do these initiatives and these quality improvement projects, is to see how we can improve and how we can move forward and give the best care possible to these little infants.
Since the legislature has approved prenatal care for women as soon as they find out that they're pregnant for 12 months, is that going to be a really important gauge in how to move this issue forward?
I would say yes. A lot of times that is one of the reasons that moms don't get prenatal care in that first trimester, is because they are waiting to be approved for their health care. And so just being able to have access to that, but then also, you know, just thinking about more rural areas in Mississippi, just the ability to get to the clinic and having clinics that are available to those mothers, especially in areas like the Delta, are just another concern for Mississippians.
What are the challenges for survival? What kind of complications do micropreemies present?
That is something that we really focus on in the conference that's going on. We look at things like chronic lung disease. Babies, the lower gestational age that a baby is, the higher risk they are of having something like chronic lung disease. And when you talk about things like that, then you're talking about going home on medicines like diuretics or going home on oxygen, and then just having that support and care with home health and then follow-up visits with pulmonologists. So things like that are what this kind of conference has focused on, is are ways to that we can decrease that from happening at all.
Long-term, say they do make it through that initial challenge, those initial stages, what are the long-term prognosis?
It's very much based on how old they are at delivery. Babies that are less than 25 weeks have definitely less positive outcomes and more long-term care, more situations where they may be on oxygen for a long time, more situations where they may have to have a feeding tube placed so that they're able to provide their babies with nutrition at home. Some babies have to be on trach, so they have to be on the ventilator. So long-term, it really depends on the gestational age of the baby. Babies that are less than 25 weeks are more likely to have complications like I was just speaking about, but babies that are greater than 25 weeks have a greater chance of going home and not requiring any oxygen at home, not requiring the feeding tubes, and just being able to go home. Do recommend and do follow up with a lot of things like physical therapy, speech therapy. They have developmental clinics here that they follow up with afterwards, and these are to make sure that the kids are meeting the milestones that they are supposed to be meeting. And then if they're not, what kind of supplemental therapy can we provide for them? It's definitely a partnership. You know, in the hospital, we're doing a lot of things, but then once they go home, we have to make sure that they have the follow-up support that they need to continue to grow and mature the way that they need to.
All of this sounds very expensive.
Yes, it can be, for sure.
And so who pays for this? Certainly, most families couldn't afford this.
In Mississippi, a lot of these babies would qualify for Medicaid, and Medicaid does provide the different therapies that the babies need. So that is one way that they do.
In terms of the child growing up and being healthy, what are the challenges there? Are there any?
If they were to have to go home on oxygen or with a feeding tube, just going to the point where, you know, getting off of those things and having all of the follow-ups, that's one of the challenging things for the families, is just having to make it to all of the appointments that are needed. Usually these babies are followed by cardiology and pulmonology, the developmental clinic that they go to. So there are lots of follow-ups involved. But like I said, with these follow-ups and with the physical therapy and with the occupational therapy, it definitely makes them have better outcome just continuing the care once they go home.
Neonatal nurse practitioner Katie Fulton with St. Dominic Hospital, thank you so much for sharing with us this important issue and the work you're doing to increase the survival rate of preemies, especially micro preemies.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new book shares the experience of a NPR journalist who left the white evangelical church. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pohl Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Said. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
This is MPB Think Radio, Mississippi Public Broadcasting.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. A new book tells the story of a woman who grew up deeply invested in the evangelical church and later left it behind. Sarah McCammon is author of the new book, The Evangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's a political correspondent with NPR. McCammon says the beliefs that she grew up with in the church are now major cornerstones of the far-right political movement.
You know, I had had my own very personal and private experience of probably something many people who grew up in strict religious backgrounds can relate to, which is growing up trying to make sense of what I thought about my faith and what I wanted that to look like in my adult life. And for me, that meant that, you know, exploring beyond the evangelical movement, exploring a variety of other traditions within Christianity, and also, you know, learning about other faiths. And that happened in my early 20s, again, quite privately, and sometimes painfully, because making a change sometimes means unintentionally maybe hurting or offending people that you're close to. But I had gone through that. And then, you know, many years later, by my mid-30s, I was assigned to cover the 2016 campaign. And I had grown up in the evangelical movement. I had seen, you know, up close sort of how many white evangelicals think about, you know, not just theology, but also politics. And suddenly, white evangelicals were a huge part of the story as I was covering the Trump campaign. You know, so many journalists, myself included, were doing stories about Donald Trump and his relationship to evangelicals, how they were responding to him, especially in light of his, you know, personal character. You know, I found myself doing a lot of stories about this group that I had grown up in. And then near the end of that campaign, I was doing a story about how evangelical women were reacting to the release of the Access Hollywood video in which, you know, Trump bragged about grabbing women by their private parts. And some of these women were really concerned about the alliance between their evangelical churches and Trump. And one of the women that we interviewed used this word ex-evangelical. She said, you know, I don't feel like I identify with the evangelical label anymore. I'm just trying to come up with a different way to talk about my faith. And that kind of set me on a journey for several years of paying attention to this word, ex-evangelical. And I discovered that there are, you know, online spaces, Facebook groups, hashtags on social media, podcasts in which people are having very public conversations about their faith, about what it means to be evangelical and whether that is a, you know, a label that works for them. And some of them use the term ex-evangelical. So I just found it useful because it kind of signifies an experience that I had had far, you know, long ago of sort of coming from a community, rethinking my relationship to it, and then trying to figure out where to go next. And I really wanted to write a book about what that feels like, because we are in a time of a lot of religious change in the United States.
What we're seeing is white evangelicals moving towards nationalism. There is also concern about misogyny in churches, period. And then there's also the added concern about race, people of color, and how white evangelicals view people of color. What did you learn growing up in this environment about those things?
Well, it's interesting because I think there were mixed messages. You know, on the one hand, I was told, and I'm really grateful that I was taught this, that everyone is equal in God's eyes, that we are all brothers and sisters and children of God, and that race shouldn't matter in the sense of, you know, people shouldn't be looked at differently because they're a different skin color. I was taught that, you know, equality is important, that racism and segregation are bad. At the same time, many of the churches, you know, the church, most of the church groups and environments that I was raised in were pretty segregated. And this is something that, you know, I think that many church leaders have been aware of and even concerned about for a long time. It was something my pastors talked about. It's something that Dr. Martin Luther King famously talked about, you know, the segregation of the Sunday morning hour. And so I think it was something that we paid at least lip service to trying to address. And I think many people in my community sincerely wanted to have more relationships across racial lines. But the reality is it wasn't usually that way. These spaces were and often still are overwhelmingly white. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And some of them, you know, go back to the history of Christianity in America and the fact that, you know, the church was much of the, particularly the evangelical church, was divided along racial lines dating back to the years of slavery. And that's something that, you know, groups like the Southern Baptist Convention have since apologized for, but it is a part of that history. And, you know, in talking particularly to Black Christians who've spent time in predominantly white evangelical spaces, evangelical churches, seminaries, and so forth, one of the themes I heard was just a sense that as much as some of their white brothers and sisters might express a desire to be more integrated and more connected, they weren't always prioritizing the issues that mattered to them. You know, so some of the folks I talked to, you know, described feeling really alienated when they saw their fellow churchgoers, you know, voting for someone like Donald Trump, who they saw as very hostile to policies that would be in their best interest, someone who actively was working against their best interest. I also talked to people, and I talked to some white evangelical, former white evangelicals as well, who were distressed by the way their churches responded to the police killing of George Floyd in 2020, and just a sense that some of these white congregations weren't taking these calls for racial justice seriously enough.
Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you'd like to share?
I just want to say again that I really hope that this book will help people who are trying to make sense of, you know, their own relationship to spirituality. I think, you know, it's not an anti-religion book. It's not anti-Christianity. It is simply my story and the stories of, you know, dozens of other people that I interviewed. And a product of a lot of research. I did a lot of research about the rise of the evangelical movement and its intersection with the Christian right and the Trump movement today. And so I hope it will help sort of explain in a really granular way some of the social and spiritual and theological factors that have helped lead to where we are today. Because the evangelical movement has had such an outsized influence on American politics, and obviously still does today.
Sarah McCannon, a political correspondent with NPR and the author of The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about what you are sharing about your life and exposing, helping people to get a better handle on what is going on and what has happened in the past involving evangelicals.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.